Morning Council, the Minnesota Court of Appeals is back in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Flory, Judge Smith, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
Good morning, Council. You can hear me okay, yes?
Yes, good morning.
Yes.
Good. Today is March 11, 2021. We are here for our third of three cases on our oral argument calendar today, A21341, in the matter of the welfare of the child of VR and JN. Counsel, I'll just ask that you mute your microphone if you're not speaking. The marshal is showing a running clock of your time. You'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant will also have 5 minutes for a rebuttal if you choose to use that. I'd ask that you identify yourself before you begin speaking because the matter is being recorded. And with that, counsel, you may proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Jennifer Thompson. I represent the appellant JN in this matter. The scope of review here is based on the direct appeal from a default judgment. So it's rather limited to whether the evidence supports the findings and the findings support the conclusions. And that references Nazar v. Nazar. It's appellant's position that the evidence presented in the record does not support the findings of fact, and the findings are reviewed for clear error. It's appellant's position that the district court erred in its application of the standards, respective standards of proof. First, in the prima facie finding that the petition established prima facie that appellant had a prior involuntary termination of parental rights. The reason why it is so important that this be recognized is because it was used to establish the rebuttable presumption of unfitness, which was the agency's statutory basis for the termination here.
But didn't you acknowledge that that is in fact the case, Ms. Thompson, in your briefing?
That there is a prior involuntary?
Yes.
Yes, it does exist. It doesn't relieve the agency of its burden of showing it. The mere mention of a fact or the existence of a prior order isn't sufficient. It's not a preponderance. It's not even prima facie to show a fact finder without any prior knowledge of the circumstances that something does exist.
So let me ask you, I mean, why do we get to those issues when both of you in your briefing here today have acknowledged that the district court abused its discretion by proceeding with sua sponte with a default hearing?
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. We need not reach the question. However, as the court knows, it only takes one statutory basis to terminate a parent's rights. So if the court disagrees with me and with Mr. Baker that the district court did not abuse its discretion, then we still need to refute the statutory basis that was put in place to terminate his parental rights. And that was the presumption of palpable unfitness.
So your client appeared at the admit deny hearing and a virtual hearing, but did not appear at the pretrial here. What is in the record other than counsel's statement that she's been having a hard time reaching him? My question is, what's in the record to show what efforts were made to allow your client to appear virtually at this pretrial hearing?
Other than his counsel at the time having contact with him, there is no record that the agency requested a writ or provided any means for the correctional facility to allow his appearance.
All right. And my understanding from the record, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that everybody was appearing virtually at this pretrial hearing. Is that right?
That is correct. It has been relatively common recently that there is a limited number of virtual connections. This is unique, I think, to our circumstances at this time. So if all the virtual appearances are used up, it's entirely possible that even if there were a means for his appearance, that he didn't make the cut that day, which is entirely beyond his control.
Counsel, can I ask it a little different question? The district court made a finding that your client was not going to be available in the reasonably foreseeable future, right?
That's correct.
And is it correct that the district court was aware that he was scheduled at least to be released in December?
I believe it's in the petition, Your Honor, and I am fairly confident it was also testified to that day.
Okay, so the hearing was, or at least the findings were issued on October 2nd, and then he was available ostensibly to appear sometime in December. Are you claiming that the finding by the district court that he was not going to be available to appear in the reasonably foreseeable future is clearly erroneous?
I am claiming that, Your Honor. I think that the last day of September was when this hearing was held, and the order, as you said, was issued October 2nd. His date of release was December, 2 months in a child's lifetime for taking on the requirement is that he be able to rehabilitate himself and establish that parental relationship in the reasonably foreseeable future. 2 months in the life of a child is a moment. So I do argue that it was clear error to find that he wasn't available in the reasonably foreseeable future.
And it's also correct that there was an agreement that was ostensibly reached for a voluntary termination?
That is what the assistant county attorney stated on the record that day, that the parties had all reached an agreement. And my client's counsel at the time also stated she had been able to speak with him and understood his position in agreeing to that.
So ostensibly, if we remanded this for a new hearing, it would be for consideration of the voluntary termination petition?
Essentially. And frankly, the impact of an involuntary termination is so very different from a voluntary termination that I think it is worthwhile to make that distinction. My client has a prior involuntary termination, which was also for failure to appear. So there has never been an opportunity to provide a factual basis for palpable unfitness. There is only default here. And so in the discretion of a county attorney in the future, whether or not to bring a petition for straight to termination under 260.012, looking at two prior involuntary terminations would definitely influence their decision to seek involuntary again. If the second termination was voluntary, it may hold some sway there in giving him a chance to parent. Give me one moment, please. There is much discussion in both briefs about the default rule 19.01 and the presentation of evidence in support of the petition. While II does make it clear that the procedure for a default hearing only allows presentation of evidence in support of the petition, it does not preclude cross-examination. The agency is still to be held to its burden of the preponderance of the evidence. And without that basic trial right of cross-examination, it's conclusory entirely for the agency to enter its evidence. And I do believe as a fundamental right that as a parent, parenthood being a fundamental right that is guaranteed due process, that cross-examination as a right of a party under 32.02 is absolutely included there, even if evidence is not to be presented in opposition to the petition.
Does the record indicate that counsel asked to cross-examine and was denied that right?
It does not. It also doesn't indicate that the court offered her, recognized her, or offered her the opportunity to cross. I also argue in my brief that appellant was denied due process under precedent in that he was denied the right to an impartial decision maker and the right to a reasonable decision based solely on the record. In this matter, the decision maker had participated in the prior involuntary termination of his rights and of mother's rights, and with great deference to the district court judge and great respect for her, I do see that discretion was abused in the way this hearing was handled. The precedent in Coates is that a default judgment will be overturned if a hearing is a sham and a pretense. Reading the transcript for this proceeding, there is but two questions about my client as to the social worker's understanding that he had a prior involuntary termination. Yes, that was what her claim was. And when was it? She didn't know. I understand the argument that then if there is a prior involuntary termination, it doesn't reach reasonable efforts. But since that prima facie finding was invalid, the only reasonable efforts offered to my client were DNA testing. And there was a claim of case management services, but there was no specificity there. So in reviewing the transcript for this, while I hesitate to use the language sham and pretense, that is the precedential language, it was held very informally. The majority of the hearing concerned a party who was not even subject to the petition. And the tone of the entire hearing was somewhat aloof and, as I said prior, conclusory. It's also Pellant's argument that the findings do not support the conclusions. The findings, having been made by clear error, do not support the conclusions that it is in the, first of all, the conclusion that there is a prior involuntary termination and that creates the presumption of palpable unfitness. Secondly, that it's in the child's best interests. There is a lack of any analysis as to the child's best interests in this. The only subject that is brought up by the guardian ad litem is that they have had no prior contact. So there really is no analysis even of the balance of the parent-child interests, competing interests, in making the best interest determination. And if your honors don't have any questions, I will yield my time.
Anything else from the panel? All right. Thank you very much, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Just one moment, Mr. Baker. All right. Anytime you're ready, counsel, you're on mute still.
Thank you. If it may please the court. Certainly an unusual argument for me to make here to say that it's, you know, what is the basis for reversal? Usually I'd be here trying to argue how the decision was proper, how the high burden or high standard of review was not met. But in this case, it was on that issue of whether to proceed by default, the default hearing or continuing, that we have a problem with. When we file these petitions, we take seriously that the effect we're going to have on the individual parent's life, the child's life. In this case, we reached a resolution to have a voluntary termination. Now, but that was rejected out of hand. The court noted that the person, Mr. Norberg, was not there, but did not inquire into the why. Don't know if he was in prison, violating rules of behavior up there, or if he was just simply not getting hooked up in the right room for this. We just don't know. And I think before you make a major determination on ending someone's rights, again, that should be inquired into.
I mean, counsel, it is concerning that there was a, I would say, dismissive response to the, when the district court was informed that there was a voluntary termination. Why is it that the county didn't make this argument at the district court? Why is it that you didn't ask for the matter to be slowed down so that dad could appear?
Well, I do wish my assistant would have done that. But it's also true that it's a discretion up to the court which how to proceed. Certainly the rule uses the language of may proceed. And, you know, it's tough for an attorney appearing there to just tell the district court that, hey, you're getting it wrong. I'm refusing to go forward, because that would have been potentially the judge's next step to say, no, you're going to go forward. Then that creates a a problem over, I think it's kind of certain decorum issues. I still wish he would have done it, but that didn't happen.
Bottom line here, Mr. Baker, are you asking this court to reverse this matter and remand for further proceedings?
Yes, I am. I think it's the right thing to do. When this has come up in other things, when I've had them come in my office, the issue of when you have people incarcerated, you know, the steps you need to take. And it's always concerning when someone has a basis for, I call them bypass TPRs, like egregious harm, involuntary terminations or transfers of custody. If we might create an underclass of individuals whose only reason for having their rights terminated was their incarceration. It doesn't mean it's always the case. You can't proceed that way, but it should just make you stop and make sure that they're really not interested in being apparent. You know, we still support that in this case he was, but he also agreed to the voluntary. We were all set for settlement that way. And I think it's important to bring up the HGN decision that came out. Actually, it was just days before my brief, so I'll apologize for not alluding to it earlier. But that decision makes more clear than ever that the county should be the one inquired into, do you want to proceed by default? Because we're going to have all our evidence there, proceed with the witnesses in that manner for the record to be clear, because in that decision, what ended up happening is they dismissed the entire petition. So if all the ducks aren't lined up and in a row, the whole case will go away. So I laid out on the brief why I think it should be remanded. We had an agreement for a lesser impactful resolution, the voluntary. The court was aware of this.
Do you agree that the factual finding that dad was not going to be reasonably available or available in the reasonably foreseeable future, that that's clearly erroneous given that he was scheduled to be released 6 weeks or so after the hearing? And he had made a prior appearance.
Right. Probably in that situation. It's so close in time. I don't know if the court in its decision will reach the presumption or the sufficiency, but with HG in mind, this seems to be almost like the one of the rare situations with a very limited record where it applied, because the only fact that needs to be proven to establish the TPR factor is the prior existence of the involuntary. And that had two individuals' testimonies that did in fact exist. And if that's deemed to be sufficient, then palpable unfitness is established. Reasonable efforts aren't required under 260.012. And then finally, best interests. We had both the guardian and the social worker testifying to that. Their basic testimony was dad wasn't involved in the child's life. The guardian actually did a pretty good job at that hearing of at least citing to the verbiage of the test, looking at the interests of the child and the child-parent relationship and that analysis. So, and I believe that was sufficient. Then you review that under clear error. So appellant wanted that there be a factual basis for why the prior involuntary. I don't think that's needed. Why the court file number or dates. And I submit that although that may be better evidence, it's still reviewed under clear. And we had two people arguing that or testifying what did exist, and appellant doesn't refute that it existed now. As regards to the rule itself, the default rule, the evidence in support of the petition, our position would be that, yes, the evidence is only in support. Cross-examination is in the form of rebutting that petition, which seems to be a departure from what the rule allows. And if the rule is provides for these trial rats elsewhere, don't know why the Supreme Court rules would not provide for it in the default rule. Unless there are other questions, I have nothing else.
I have one question.
Sure.
You make it clear in your brief and you argue, Mr. Baker, that the court's finding that your office requested to proceed in default was a clearly erroneous finding. From your arguments here today, I assume that remains your position. And if it does, then, you know, how or where does that factor into our determination as to whether or not the process that was followed here was proper?
I think it's key. It's the brief outlines the how exactly, kind of line by line, where the court proceeded, where the court was the one directing. I guess I have the transcript now. It's page 2, lines 23 through 25, where the court says both parties have been served. They're notified. They are in default. I will allow it to proceed by default. That's when the assistant attorney mentioned, hey, we have an agreement. Judge just said, well, that person's not here. And then the court asked about prior involuntaries. And then the court herself said, I guess I'll place Miss Barber, the guardian ad litem, and the social worker under oath. And then she swore him in. So the court was driving the default, that it was proceed by default. Mm-hmm. And I think with HGN in place, it's even more important, because if we don't have our witnesses there, the entire petition will get kicked out according to that decision.
Thank you.
Anything else, counsel? Counsel, anything else?
Oh, sorry. Nothing else. Sorry.
All right. Thank you very much. Ms. Thompson, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just very briefly, I agree with Mr. Baker that the agency should be driving the default, obviously, and I did not make that request in this point, in this proceeding. As to the point whether cross-examination is a rebuttal of the evidence, of course it is. And it is, if this were a prima facie finding of just submitting evidence into the record, it would be different. But the burden is a preponderance. And so without any cross-examination, without any rebuttal, the agency doesn't have a very high burden there, a very low bar to get over. I would also like to circle back to Mr. Baker's comment about creating an underclass of people who are bypassed, TPR'd, involuntarily terminated without any access to justice, frankly, and refer to Justice Page's dissent in the welfare of the children of Dolores Coates. His comments there about failure to personally attend hardly constitutes grave and weighty reason to justify entry of a default on the merits of a termination petition. And he there refers to default judgment as an extreme sanction that is not warranted in this case. There's also commentary in his dissent about the nature of due process being flexibility, that the circumstances in this situation called for some flexibility on behalf of the court. And though it was not requested by the agency or by my client's counsel at the time to continue, I do continue to argue that it was an abuse of discretion not to set this on for a later evidentiary hearing. I have nothing further. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel. The matter is submitted. We will issue an opinion within the statutory time period.